Mitzad echad ksheva, mifnei tzvadim trefa. If a needle is found in the reticulum, that's one of the four stomachs of the cow, if it's found only on one side, the animal is ksheva. If it's found penetrated all the way through, the animal is trefa. Nimtza aleha kot dam. If there is a blood clot, biyadua shelifnei shvita. If there was no bleeding associated with this, then you know that the needle had penetrated after Shvita. That's not what's relevant to us. So, although if you remember, there was a scare recently. if you like, we can discuss that briefly. It's really a weird situation. Okay. Higlit pi hamaka. If the wound has a scab, then it is known for sure that this needle has penetrated the wall of the reticulum at least 3 days prior to the shvita. So therefore, if the animal had been sold, say, 1 day prior to the shvita, that means that this needle had penetrated the reticulum in the possession of the seller, and therefore the presumption is that it's the seller's responsibility and he has to refund the money to the purchaser. Lo higlit pi hamaka hamotzi michavero alav haraya. If there is no scab formed on this wound, then we don't have sure evidence as to when the needle actually penetrated the wall of the reticulum, and it is the purchaser can't demand his money back without further proof. Okay. That's the Gemara that I want to discuss. Okay. So here's a situation in which obviously there's no way that the seller could have known that his cow has ingested a needle prior to the sale, and therefore it becomes trefa. So it's certainly not even the slightest danger of fraud here. Nevertheless, the Gemara says that if you can prove that this needle was found, that this puncture had taken place prior to the sale, it is the seller's responsibility. Okay, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if I had to devise a law here, I could come down on either side, right? I mean, this is, in general, one wants to preserve sale and contract. And therefore, I could equally well just apply the principle of mistakha sadeu, of caveat emptor. Why should the purchaser be liable here for the case more than the seller? I mean, I don't have any strong personal feelings on this one way or the other. It's clear that you need a firm rule because you don't want to have confusion, but I don't believe that in a situation like this, there is necessarily any strong reason to put the burden on one side rather than the other. Okay, but the Gemara does say in a situation that when the goods are definitely damaged prior to the sale, then even though the seller has no way of knowing that these goods are damaged, he's going to bear the burden of responsibility. That seems to be what the Gemara is saying. As I say, I could live with this, I could live with the alternative. It's interesting, however, that the Rush raises, so this is on my page 6b, the Rush raises a question. The Rush is not yet on the computer, unfortunately. So this is about halfway down the first right-hand column. Huglat pi hamakah biyadua shiyishlosha yamin kodem shvita. Lo huglat pi hamakah hamotzi michavero alav haraya. If there's no evidence as to when this puncture of the reticulum took place, it's up to the purchaser to prove that the animal became trade before. Even though there no money has been transferred. Normally, means that whoever holds the money, the person who's in possession, just keeps his money. But he said, Rush has explained to us that here, that's not what means. It doesn't matter whether payment has been made in advance or not. It just means, that in this case, the Allah Haraiya refers to the purchaser. Okay. So that's a technicality, which is okay, but it's not relevant. Dafka trefot, the machmat maka uchil seba, the eno matsud, molo salika daite the inish litnuy. The Rabbeinu Ephraim and the Baal HaItur say that this rule that the seller is liable only applies to uncommon trefot, not to common ones. Because for the common ones, the purchaser should have stipulated as part of his contract that the if the animal is trefot, if there's a problem with the lungs and so on, I don't have to pay. The fact that the purchaser didn't make this stipulation when he was well aware of this danger means that he was willing to accept the burden of risk. That's what the Katav Rabbeinu Ephraim came out of it. Dafka trefalt the machmat makal fiyotzeba the enu matzuri v'lo salika da'ite the inish litnuya. Aval trefalt the machmat sircha. But a problem with the lungs, the Mishkach Shriach, which is a common source of trefot, the Rami Inish Adate, and people are alert to the frequency of that particular trefot, Kevan Delo Itni Badi Achil Achile Velo Hapi Mekach Tal. Since the purchaser did not explicitly stipulate that it was the seller's responsibility to bear the burden of risk, then the purchaser himself was willing to bear the burden of risk, and therefore seller doesn't have to reimburse him for a sircha, if that's what happened. Vahar Ramban, it should be the Ramban, not the Ramban. Vahar Ramban zal katav, da afilu tveifot machmat sircha nami havi mekach tachot, Shaharim b'mocher shor l'chaveiro b'nimtza nagchan l'chuli alma ilo matzi lo matzi amale d'shchita machar tiv l'chavi mekach ta'ot d'af al gav lo rit mi lokeach. It's a well-known halacha in the Gemara and Bava Metzia, v'ene hulchin m'mon acharov, that if a person sells an ox to somebody else and it turns out that he is a dangerous ox, then the purchaser could have demanded his money back unless there's a reasonable case to be made that he bought the animal for meat. So the Ramban disagrees. V'linire, the Rush writes, the Kedivrei Rabbeinu Ephraim Zal V'Wal Ha'itu. The Hachinami Machligidon B'Ren Tabatan at Ones V'Yitin, the Ones V'Shkiach V'Chul Yama Intan at Ones V'Yitin, and Meno Neru, Ma Shevi Ramban Raya Mishor V'Ever Lav Raya Hu, the Shani Hatam Shemokher Makir B'Mumei Hashor V'Ha'Ever. There's a presumption that the seller knows that this slave or this bull are dangerous, and therefore he should be responsible if something like this happens. And the purchaser was relying on the good faith of the seller, and therefore didn't have to stipulate. Because there's a presumption on the part of the buyer that there's no explicit flow. Aval b'davar she'ein ha'malcher yodea, kamo she'halokeach eino yodea, in a situation where neither the buyer or the seller are in a position to know the facts, boy leila lokeach litnuyei b'midi d'shkiach, because of foreseeable risks, the lokeach certainly should make an explicit clause. And would lo itni, if he didn't make this explicit clause, ichuli achil v'kana kedar kol lokei behemot she'eino nimnim lokeach b'shvil safek trefo. Since normally people buy animals and don't take the issue of the risk of it being a trefa into account, if it's a common trefa, since this is something that the buyer should have been aware of and didn't explicitly stipulate against, if it was a common trefa, the Rosh says, in agreement with Rabbeinu Ephraim and the Balai too, a buyer bears the burden of risk rather than the seller. It's only one of these very exceptional things that the buyer couldn't have foreseen and therefore couldn't have stipulated. That's what the Rosh says. And I think that's just a miscalculation. And let's think about the Rosh for a minute. I mean, let's see what he's saying. I mean, this is all a matter of price, right? I mean, who bears the burden of risk is going to be reflected in the buying agreement. So suppose, what I'm claiming here is that I think that this is just simply an error on the part of the Rush in calculating what's going on here. And this has nothing to do with the Gemara Megillah that we saw about the unexpected event of a flood coming to a field. I mean, suppose you have a 20% risk of Siachot of the lungs, and a 1% risk of a needle being found in the reticulum, for example. Then obviously, if the buyer is going to bear the burden of this risk, or if the seller is going to bear the burden of this risk, it should be reflected, roughly speaking, in about 20% of the purchase price. You're going to pay more for a guarantee, for an animal guaranteed against a siyacha, than you're going to pay for an animal that's not guaranteed against the siyacha. So the Rosh is saying the fact that you didn't stipulate against the siyacha means that you're willing to pay this price, which means that had you wanted to stipulate against the siyacha, you probably would have been asked to pay a 20% increase to cover that risk. Well, obviously a 1% increase is negligible in comparison to a 20%. In other words, if you're going to maintain that the purchase if the thing that the man was going to protect it himself is extremely rare, then the fact that he didn't protect himself against a larger risk doesn't mean that he's transferring the burden of risk of a rarer thing to the seller. Am I making myself clear? I think on this particular issue the Ramban is clearly correct and the Rabbeinu Ephraim and the Balai Yitro are wrong. In the case of the risk of the unexpected risk of the government diverting the canal and passing it through the field, this was a type of risk whose probability was extremely small, but once it happens, the cost is enormously large, right? It's much more, it costs a huge amount of money to just the entire purchase price of the field. And obviously, therefore, when the seller said that he was going to guarantee against all possible defects, what he meant was cover court costs if there are liens made against the thing or other minor things, so that therefore even the event that was extremely rare but nevertheless had an extremely large effect, he didn't intend to guarantee it. So in a situation like this, that doesn't matter whether the animal is a trefa because of a neket or the animal is a trefa because of a sircha. If we maintain that the purchaser is willing to undertake the risk of a sircha, then certainly he's willing to undertake the risk of a machlokes. because...
So therefore, I think that this is just...
As I said, the issue of a puncture in the reticulum, what has finally happened with this scandal of
rare enough.
It's passed. I mean, how have they changed the percentages? I mean, what was the original intent of?
Animals, because of their diet, they develop gas. So in order to relieve their gas in the stomach, they puncture.
Mm-hmm.
How?
It's a procedure.
I mean, the whole business is scandalous because this procedure has been around for 400 or 500 years. This is not a new procedure. It's mentioned in the in Hadras HaTul. It certainly was around when I was studying the other day, 40 years ago. And there's even a tshuva of Rav Moshe dealing with these procedures when it had to do with the actual meat in the slaughtering houses, where he advised against buying from farms where this procedure was known to be common. But nobody in his right mind wanted to prohibit the milk. I mean, people have been drinking milk. Moshe knew very well that milk comes from cows. It's not a new discovery. And these procedures have been known for all this time. And as far as I can tell, there's no evidence whatsoever that there's any increase in the frequency of this procedure. Is there evidence of that? So it's just been absolutely outrageous.
Some of my good side stuff is milk from houses are sure not to have.
There's also an ideological question here, which I think is very serious. And one, you know, we've discussed this. How many of us were here when we were studying Hilchos Kvetos? You were here, Mel. The problem is this, which I think is also serious, and I think you remember the conclusions that we came to when we were studying the plant. I mean, do we take medical knowledge into account when we're deciding the Hilchos Kvetos? If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, for example, not in the question of the Kvetos of the Keres and the Keva, where this is, but if you take a look in the Shulchan Aruch, say, of the Treifos of the Lay, you'll see the statement at the very beginning by the Shulchan Aruch that the heart has three chambers, right? Shalosh, Shosha Chalali in the Lay. We don't believe that particularly today. I mean, today either the heart has two chambers or it has four, but three is a difficult number to come by. Also, for example, at the end of that Simon Shulchanov, you remember, the Ramah says that if a needle is found in the heart facing the right way, then there's no worry about it having puncture or going to puncture anything, because in the course of time, the animal will cough it out. Right? The needle in the reticulum is not an uncommon phenomenon. It's not common. The needle in the heart. When were we studying this paper? About 10 years ago or 15 years ago? Well, the last time I studied the issue of the needles, I couldn't find, in terms of the statistics, needles in animal hearts were extremely rare. Needles in human hearts were quite common because they broke off from the IVs. This was a common cause of death, apparently, in the hospitals, when IV needles would break off and travel up to the heart and kill the patient. When you say no, I... This was not an uncommon phenomenon. I was just looking at the statistics, you know. But in any event, that's not the point that I'm trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make is that obviously, at the time that the Ramon was writing, if you looked at the best medical books, Vesalius or Leonardo or what have you, you saw very clearly that the side of the heart that was connected to the lungs was full of air, and one had a direct connection between the arterial system, or that side of the heart, and the trachea. And it was only at the beginning of the 17th century, starting with Vesalius, who more or less lost his life for having made this discovery, namely that there are no pores in the septum where blood can seep across the wall from one chamber to the other, which is the Galenic theory. And he doubted that, and then you had Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood. So nowadays, of course, even a fourth grade child can tell you that it's impossible for a needle to get out of any chamber of the heart to the outside by simply coughing without making a hole somewhere. And our problem is how to deal with advances of medical knowledge when they show that some of the things that we see in Hilchot Tosfos are simply incorrect. The Rambam, if you remember, wrote that even though we nowadays don't believe that this is going to cause the animal to die or vice versa, we don't change it. But of course, the Rambam was dealing within the same framework as the Gemara. They were both dealing within the framework of Galenic medicine. And the Rambam, I think, quite accurately, if we look at it today, certainly the Rambam's position was correct, because I don't think that we believe the Rambam's medicine any more than we believe the Gemara's medicine, or vice versa. So that therefore, when the Rambam wrote that current medical knowledge should not overturn Hilchot Shreifot, that's certainly not applicable when there have been major changes in medical knowledge, like the discovery of the circulation of blood, or the germ theory of disease, and so on. And therefore, it seems to me a difficult decision to make, irrespective of the issue of prevalence or anything else, to decide that a medical procedure, which is known to be effective and work, where the whatever damage is done is immediately stitched up and so on, should make an animal safer. And since in this particular case, we have a tradition going back to the Hadassah tool, and certainly the Aruch HaShulchan writing that this procedure at the worst makes the animal a subject to a fine. If it lives for 12 months, you certainly can keep the meat in a situation like that to cause a scandal. The procedure has been known to all of us who've been involved.
The Aruch didn't mention that.
Well, I'm just saying.
It's interesting. I'm just saying that it's an interesting fact.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I realize that, you know, there are certain issues which say that maybe the belief in the theory of evolution does or does not contradict the fundamental principle of Judaism. I don't know. I would hope not. But certainly, the belief in the circulation of the blood should not be an issue on which we have to take a religious stand. I think it's possible to be a former Yid and still believe in the theory of circulation of blood. And on this particular thing, I think it was just a complete outrage that this whole scandal was raised. There was no, as far as I could tell from looking at it, having investigated the statistics, there was no new information or phenomenon that was taking place that I was unaware of when I was a kid learning Book of Spreitas 40 some odd years ago.
You know who began it? I don't even know who began it.
I think it cuts further on email.
Yeah. No, I know that was a transmission mechanism of questions.
No, I think this, I think that, no, furthermore, it's completely outrageous. This would never have happened. You know, the idea that you, that a whole community can be brought to be suspect. I mean, whenever a situation like this occurred in traditional Jewish communities, if there was a certain community practice that you and contradicted what it said in the book, you explain away the book. You don't. What are the Baalei HaTosfot about? They read the Gemara and they see that the current practice doesn't follow what the Gemara says, so therefore they make some adjustment in explaining why what it says in the Gemara doesn't apply to their situation. And for the people to come up and to say that that Rabbi Soloveitchik and Moshe Feinstein and all and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and all of us who've been drinking milk in this country for the last 50 or 60 years have been consuming treifos, just the very idea of saying that is completely accurate. Well, you saw Chaim's article. Have you seen that excellent article? None of you have seen that. Chaim Soloveitchik. An absolutely brilliant article on the new role of texts in the Haredi community. I mean, he said Haredi community, of course, but he meant the Orthodox community.
Where did this come
from? Who has a copy of this? Do you have a copy?
I don't.
I have a copy here, but I don't.
It would take me too long to find it. I wasn't planning to discuss this tonight.
But this whole phenomenon of disregarding practice completely and trying to reconstruct Judaism from scratch, from book learning, is the issue that he addresses. And it's absolutely brilliant.
But that is the ideological.
No, there are two
arguments going on.
There are two arguments that are going on. One is this broad ideological question of the loss of faith and continuity, and that's the problem that Chaim is addressing. And I'm saying that there's a completely different ideological argument that's going on that has to do with, are you going to completely deny the role of major scientific advances when it comes to applying the halacha? May I remind you what the Chazon Ish says on this issue, which is, so, I hate to use the word crazy, outrageous. I mean, what does the Chazon Ish say? The Chazon Ish says that, first of all, nature has changed, so therefore any contradiction that we see between the medicine or the medical statements in the Gemara and what we know today is due to the fact that there have been changes in nature. He was aware of the contradictions, like, for example, the Gemara saying that in the male, in the penis, there are two parts, Shneishvili, right? That the vas deferens is separated from the ureter, and therefore that there are two paths, and the Gemara deals with the question of what happens if the membrane separating these two paths is punctured at one place or another. And the fact that current medical knowledge says that the vas deferens joins up in the body near the prostate gland, and there's only one channel within the penis, is the Chazon Ish was aware of that contradiction and tries to explain it away also by saying that maybe this is a change in nature. Because if you remember when we were studying this, I showed you Leonardo da Vinci's anatomical drawings where you clearly see these two paths, because that was a standard piece of Galenic medicine. It was not something that was peculiar to the Gemara particularly. All right, that's bad enough. But then he goes on to say that he takes the following position, namely that the laws of Treifos were given to the Chazal to decide. This is in general in keeping with his radical position that dinim d'oraisa were only given in a vague form and were eventually crystallized by Chazal. And therefore, and then he goes on to say that even if that therefore, since the laws of Tzvetos were established by Chazal, and only they had the right to actually formulate these laws, and nature has changed, then by definition, Trefa means something that had the animal had this particular affliction at the time of the Gemara, it would have been a fatal affliction, then that makes the animal Trefa. And even though nowadays this is not a fatal affliction, so I think that even at the highest level there's been really a reluctance to come to grips with this. But if you remember that when we were studying Hilchos Tzvetos, what we decided was that rather than take this position in any situation where we had any other smith lehetta, we certainly would rely on modern medical knowledge. And therefore, in a case like this, even if there wasn't a less than 1 or 2% of the animals being afflicted with this, I would be matir. On straight grounds of dealing with Hilchos Tzvetos, having nothing to do with the issue of people below. But that's my mind, the whole problem is that way. Okay, am I out of time? What time is it? 9:27. All right. The next thing that I Xerox for you is just a short excerpt from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, dealing with the...
You don't have that on CD-ROM?
Yeah. Is it? The 11th edition is on CD-ROM? I doubt it. I mean, it's a great encyclopedia. It misses some things like World War I and World War II and things like that. But basically, it's still better than the more recent version.
What's the date?
1910 and stuff like that. So I just, you can read it yourselves. I don't think it's not my reading encyclopedia of that. So this terminates, I think, the classical position. What I want to do, I guess we'll take it up next week, is to go through the Tshuva literature to get some feel for how this notion of caveat emptor in Tarchos Sadeu actually was dealt with in practice. There's some interesting twists and turns here. And again, due to computer facility, I can actually summarize everything in the front, which is what I've done. My computer is down for this week, so therefore it's in the repair shop. Oh, the one thing that I did want to say, which I didn't include in there, is on this issue of change of attitude towards the notion of fortune and luck as being a property of the individual. It's hard to say exactly when that took place, but when I was discussing this with Chaim, he made this reference to me, and I think it's very relevant. A very interesting situation reflecting the change in attitude is how Machiavelli deals with the issue of fortuna in The Prince, where he deals with it exactly the way we would deal with it today, namely some untoward natural event, not the issue of character of a person. And it's something to be conquered or dealt with, but not an individual trait. My time is up. I would read chapter 25 or something like that. The influence of luck on human affairs and the ways to counter it. I think the attitude expressed by Machiavelli is completely the opposite of, from the attitude that we will see in the Tumas Adeshan, which has... It's one of my favorite quotes, but we'll do that again next time. Okay, so we'll continue if you have no objection with this subject of caveat emptor and the issue of luck, and probably will take us all over the next year. If I can find it.
How recent is it?
And then we start talking to
them. But I started giving
it. Yeah, I said
it
to my friend.
I'm
sure there's a situation about it.
Nice to meet you.